All right, so our first Gong Show participant is Alessio Valencia, and he's going to tell us about analog gravity, starting now.
Okay, first of all, I thank the organizer to be here. It's a pleasure for me to be here at this nice conference. I will talk about dynamical analog model, basically. And this is a work of last year based, this talk is based on work of last year with Stefano Liberati and Rich Modestissa. So let me start with a very brief, since I have only 8 minutes, introduction on what analog gravity is, since this is a topic in some sense distant from the other talks in this conference. But nevertheless, I think that analog gravity has much to offer both to the quantum gravity and to the quantum information community. So analog gravity studies condensed matter systems that share in a mathematically well-defined way properties with gravitational theories. In particular, the vast majority of the literature take into account kinematical analog that are basically system, condensed matter system, that are mathematically equivalent to quantum field theory in curved space-time. The simplest analog model that you can think of is basically surface waves on water. In a certain regime, surface waves behave like massless scalar field on a curved background. So that with this kind of system, we can simulate Tokyo radiation, and indeed, in this year, there are a lot of experimental effort to really detect Tokyo radiation in condensed matter systems, since we cannot detect Tokyo radiation really from black hole for the moment. And moreover, with this kind of system, you can also test the robustness of Tokyo radiation towards UV modification of the theory. And other stuff that you can test are simulating super radiance. For example, this image is about an experiment in collaboration between SIS and Nottingham, in which they are simulating a rotating black hole space-time, or you can test also cosmological particle production, always in laboratory, basically. And okay, this is fine, but in order to go beyond the semi-classical gravity, we need to find some analog model that share also dynamical feature with gravitational theories. Here, what I mean is that I would like to have an analog model in which not only the perturbation on top of the analog space-time behave like scalar field theory in curved space-time, but also the analog space-time itself evolve with some equation that can be cast in a gravity-like form. So basically, the aim here is to take into account also the back reaction of the perturbation on top of the analog space-time and see if we can recast the equation for the evolution of the analog space-time due to this perturbation in a gravity-like form. Then this is clearly easier to say than to do, but nevertheless, Bose-Einstein condensate have proved to be a good model, system for these studies. In particular, in 2008, Girelli, Liberati, and Sindoni shows that in a non-relativistic Bose-Einstein condensate with the soft U1 breaking term, the Boglio-Desenes equation, that is basically the Gross-Peter-Jeschke equation for the condensate plus the back reaction of the quasi-particle that propagates on top of the condensate, can be recast in a Newton gravity-like form. Basically, this is a modified Poisson equation in which the emergent gravitational potential is proportional to the order parameter of the condensate, and the source, that is this raw matter, is given by the back reaction of the quasi-particle. So what we did last year was consider something like this in a relativistic BEC, in a relativistic Bose-Einstein condensate model that, by the way, was shown to be a good kinematical analog model in 2010 by Fagnocchi et al. So here now I don't have the time to go through all the details, but we are considering basically a complex scalar field, a lambda phi to the fourth tier in the grand canonical formalism. Then one can show explicitly that there is a condensation, there is a critical temperature below which we have condensation. And after field redefinition, we end up with this starting equation for a bosonic field phi. Then we can use here mean field approximation, so we can split the bosonic field in a classical part, that is the order parameter of the condensate, plus fractional perturbation on top of the condensate. And the crucial assumption here is that we are assuming this order parameter to be real. That is, basically, we are choosing a particular condensed state. I'm not saying that this is the only state for which the Boglio-Desenio equation will assume a geometrical form, but for sure is an example. Then, if you do this assumption, the relativistic Boglio-Desenio equation assumes this form, where this last term is basically the back reaction of the quasi-particle. And the equation for the perturbation instead are these two equations that are equivalent to the equation of a massless and a massive minimally coupled scalar field on curved background. And the curved background is given by this conformally flat metric, where the conformal factor is the square of the order parameter of the condensate. Now, for this kind of metric, we know that the Ricci tensor is given by this expression. And then, going back to the Boglio-Desenio equation, we can see that that equation can be recast in an almost geometrical form, where for almost I mean that you have to take the massless limit, or at least neglect the mass term that was in that equation. And after really a field rescaling, you have to give to the field the canonical dimension, you end up with this equation. So this right-hand side is basically the back reaction that is proportional to the trace of the stress energy tensor of the perturbation, and the left-hand side is in a geometrical form. So basically, we end up with the Einstein-Fokker equation for non-strong gravity, that is a scalar theory of gravity. Here, the cosmological constant is given in terms of the coupling constant of the lambda phi to the 4 interaction and the chemical potential, and also is the emergent Newton constant. So basically, let me now conclude and wrap up. What I have said in the beginning is that analog gravity models are important tools for what regard testing effect of quantum field theory in curved background. But if we want to go beyond semi-classical gravity, we have to take in account, we have to obtain some analog model that share also dynamical feature with gravity theories. And in this respect, the model that I show you is the first step in this direction. Clearly, what are the outlook? Investigate more complex system. The system that I show you is not very rich. There is only basically one scalar field, 1 degree of freedom for the gravity sector. And there are, in condensed matter systems that are richer than these. For example, the string necked condensate that we're studying in perimeter. Then another line is to understand the formation of the analog spacetime from the point of view of the quasi-particle. So this is basically understand geometrogenesis in this kind of model. And in line with this, inspire and be inspired by quantum gravity ideas. Indeed, this kind of condensed matter and analog model tools are used right now in group field theory quantum gravity to study basically cosmological setup. And finally, this is the far future objective, would be to tackle problems like information loss that nowadays are impossible to treat with analog gravity models, since they are basically simulating a fixed background. So we need really something like an evaporating black hole. Thank you very much for your attention. Okay. Yeah. No, please.
A couple minutes for a question. Well, maybe. I've got a couple more chances. Aaron.
So if the space-time is conformally flat, how can you get a black hole?
Well, yes, indeed, this model is too simple. This is non-strong gravity in this case. Yeah, we have to investigate more complex system in which you really can obtain something like an analog black hole that is evaporating. That indeed is the far future objective.
But you can also try to study only at the classical level. Why you are also quantizing at the same time? If you want to reproduce somehow dynamic of gravity,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would be enough to study some analog model
that is
classical.
Yeah. That's true. But here, basically what we did was studying these relativistic Bose-Einstein condensates. This was a natural extension of the previous works. Moreover, if you really want to reach the final objective of studying something like an evaporating black hole, and so also something like the information problem, you need the quantized field on top of your space-time. So these are the most interesting analogs. But for sure, you can also use classical analogs. Indeed, for example, something like stimulated Yoke radiation was studied in the laboratory with the surface waves on water that are classical mm-hmm. model.
Okay, one more quick question.
What does the Bose-Einstein condensate, what kind of advantage does it give you over hydrodynamical kind of experiments?
Yeah, this is exactly what I was saying. Basically, in the Bose-Einstein condensate, the perturbation are quantized. Instead, if you take surface waves on water, they are classical waves. So you are studying classical field theory in curved spacetime, in an analog spacetime in that case.
All right, let's thank the first speaker again. Aiden has 8 minutes starting now to tell us about consistency conditions for an ADS mirror correspondence.
Okay.
Go for it.
Okay. So first off, thank you, the conference organizers, for putting this together and letting me come up here and speak in the Gong Show. And thank you for everyone for sticking around to hear the Gong Show. And today I'd like to tell you about a little bit of work with some friends that I did at Caltech about consistency conditions for an ADS mirror correspondence. This hilariously long author list is what happens when you decide to write up a group discussion. But I think it's kind of fun. And some of the people in this collaboration are in the audience. So Ning Bao is over there. Hi, Ning. And Nick is there. Hi, Nick. So anyway, you can also direct questions at them if you like. Okay, thanks. Anyway, so let's begin with quantum gravity, because I imagine that if you're in this room, you're probably at least somewhat interested in quantum gravity. So let's start there. So one question in quantum gravity is, what is the quantum nature of space-time? An interesting idea to have come out of these considerations is the idea that space-time might be emergent from some, or so space-time as we know it on large scales, smooth, nice, might be emergent from some quantum degrees of freedom. Now, I'd argue that one instantiation of this is ADS-CFT, where you have an ADS bulk being exactly correspondent to, or conjectured, to being correspondent to a CFT, so a D plus one dimensional ADS corresponding to D dimensional CFT on flat space. So you have an emergent dimension, cool. One question though, which I'd argue still remains an ADS CFT, is what is the explicit map between quantum boundary degrees of freedom and degrees of freedom in the bulk? Okay, so keep all that in head. Meanwhile, in physics, in another region of physics, we've had tensor networks appear, namely condensed matter systems. Tensor networks appeared as an efficient way to represent certain states of many-body quantum systems. This is very cool. One really cool tensor network was the MARA, which people found was a very efficient way to represent the ground states of critical many-body systems. Now, some very smart people, in particular Brian Swingle, at one point pointed out that, hey, MARA has a lot of the same features of ADS-CFT. It seems kind of ADS-CFT-esque, especially because it's good at representing the ground states of critical systems. And so it was proposed that there might be some sort of ADS-MARA correspondence. I'll define this very carefully later. And what we did in our work was to take this sort of correspondence very seriously, back up and say, okay, if we really believe there's correspondence, what sort of things, what are consistency checks that we can look at to see that this is really a good correspondence? What things should we check to make sure they hold? All right, so that's a little introduction. Let me start by telling you stuff that you already know, because I'm told that this makes an audience very happy, or it's a good way to prime an audience for a talk. So anyways, let's start with talking about tensor networks. So a tensor, you can think of it as a graphical way to display quantum state. It's just an array of numbers. You can display it as a node with some legs coming out. And it represents an array of numbers that, well, if you contract with a bunch of basis states, gives you a quantum state. So that's a tensor. And a tensor network is then just a contraction of many different tensors. Why these are particularly nice is because it's a very efficient way to represent certain classes of quantum states. So I mean, like, if you imagine that each leg just represents a qubit, this tensor would be like 2 to the 3 complex numbers. This here, if you only had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 legs, it'd be 2 to the 6 legs on the outside. the full six-dimensional system would be 2 to the 6 degrees of freedom, but if you represent it with a tensor network, really you can see there's only 4 copies of the tensor, of the same tensor that have 3 outgoing legs. So it would be really representing this 2 to the 6 degrees of freedom with only 2 to the 3 numbers. Well, all right, it's efficient. Anyways, you all know what tensor networks are. So let me now proceed and tell you about the MARA, okay? The MARA is a certain type of tensor network, this kind of tensor network. The details, oh, okay, if you've seen MARA before, you know all about the details. If you haven't seen MARA before, don't worry about the details for this talk. What's most important is to notice that, like, if you draw the MARA in this way, and you compare it to a slice of the hyperbolic plane, they look awfully similar. So this prompted Brian Swingle to conjecture that there might be a correspondence between MARA and ADS. So what we did is we investigated precisely that, a possible correspondence between ADS and MARA. So let me begin by just being very explicit by what we take their definition of an ADS-MARA correspondence to be, okay? So what we say is that, okay, an ADS-MARA correspondence means that a MARA fills out a slice of the hyperbolic plane of ADS 1 plus 1, okay? That physics on both the boundary and bulk are described by appropriate Hilbert spaces, or certain aspects of physics in the boundary and bulk are described by appropriate Hilbert spaces, which in the spirit of holography have equal dimension. The bulk Hilbert space is given by a tensor product of small Hilbert space factors localized about the nodes of ADS, localized about the nodes of the MARA to preserve some notion of locality. And lastly, we postulate that there is some map, that MARA can be used to define some map between this boundary Hilbert space and bulk Hilbert space. We're not going to say what it is. We don't really care if this map exists. And now we ask, okay, given these sets of assumptions, given this definition of an ADS-MARA correspondence, what do you need in order to make it consistent? Okay? So. Yes, it should be ADS 1 plus 2. Thank you very much. Yeah, good catch. Right. All right, so what did we do? So we have our proposed ADS-MARA correspondence, and we look at consistency conditions. So what sorts of consistency conditions can you look at? Well, first, we looked at geometry, in particular geodesics. So this is with regards to the first point. If you really believe that MARA is filling out the bulk of a slice of ADS, then you should be able to get the same answers to geometric questions posed both in the continuous ADS language and in the MARA language. So what you can do, is look at, say, geodesics in both MARA, so just kind of discrete geodesics in a graph geometry, and then geodesics in a slice of hyperbolic plane, and ask, okay, do they have the same length if you compute their length in both situations? So that's, for instance, one consistency condition that you can check. You can also now look at boundary entanglement entropy. So now, both ADS-CFT and ADS-MARA purport to have a CFT on the boundary. You can check, okay, do you reproduce your Yutaki-Nagi formula with your MARA? You can also look at bulk entanglement entropy, where now we look at the entanglement entropy of regions in the bulk spacetime and ask, okay, does it conform to the covariant entropy bound or the Busso bound? So I'll wrap up really quickly. You can ask questions if that was confusing because I only have 33 seconds left. So okay, you have two things. You have MARA, you have ADS. Is there correspondence? No, not for vanilla MARA is what we found in the end. It turns out you end up breaking consistency conditions. They're not all mutually consistent. If you'd like to know the gory details, please ask me or collaborators, read our paper. So what could you do? Well, you can modify your MARA, or you could change your definition of what you mean by ADS-MARA, or you can consider other holographic tensor networks, like the HAPI proposal that we've heard of and what Xiaolang Qi is going to tell us about tomorrow. That's about it, so thank you very much. Yes.
So when you include the bulk Hilbert space,
yes,
then the tensor network seems to be defining a map instead of a state, like when we usually think in MARA that as an ansatz of a state. But if you think it as a map, then I don't know what it means here to calculate the entropy in a bulk region. What's the entropy for what state?
Right. So entropy for what state? So all the arguments we made regarding bulk entanglement entropy are just broad arguments where you only The only thing that really matters is the dimensionality of these Hilbert space factors that make up the total block Hilbert space. So in particular, like what we did is we cast the Busso bound as Mahler constraint on the dimensionality of the bulk Hilbert space, or of collections of bulk Hilbert space factors. And with that constraint, then, well, it gives you consistency condition. Yeah. But I agree, it's a separate question to look at. Right. If you actually had a map, it'd be very cool and instructive to then look at like specific states with that map.
Yeah. So Rita Kaina is just an upper bound for entanglement, we know that felt saturated, but doesn't have to be saturated.
Ryuta Kainagi?
Yeah.
No, that's an exact one, I think, right? It's
because you have two intervals, you don't expect to get the quadratic answer from the meta perspective.
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
It looks like saturated for only for
so you're saying if you draw these lines the way you did on the tensor network, that just counting bonds isn't.
So it's So in the end, I mean, the constraints we get from it's not like an exact equation that you get when you consider boundary entanglement entropy from the mirror point of view, because I mean, to do that, you need to know your explicit mirror and the explicit say, boundary state you have. You need to know your explicit tensors. But just based on general arguments, or from arguments based on the structure of the mirror, the dimensionality of the Hilbert space is in the mirror factor, so the bond dimension, and the structure of disentanglers and isometries that go into the mirror, you can make arguments about how the entropy of any region, any contiguous region of sites on the boundary, is bounded. And in the end, that's all we consider, is just the entropy of contiguous boundary regions.
If it's quick.
It was just in comparing the Giordi sequence to your mega construct, how do you normalize the link, the distance between the regions?
Right, so that's a very good question. So in all these ADS mirror proposals, implicitly, everyone is assigning a metric to the mirror graph. I mean, the mirror really is a graph.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to talk about proper length, you need a metric on the graph. And so what we did is we were just kind of agnostic about like where this metric comes from and what it has to be. We said, okay, if you want, that's one of our consistency conditions. If you want to reproduce the right geodesic lengths, then your mirror has to have the following graph metric.
And then it ends up being some ADS scale.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay, let's. Thank you, Vinga. All right, so next, Grant Sultan is going to tell us about replicating quantum information in space-time.
All right, thank you, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to advertise this project to you all. This work, I think, is a little bit different from some of the things we've seen this week so far, but it's nevertheless interesting because it really highlights the versatility of quantum information theory, all the way from things as fundamental as quantum gravity, which I guess you all like, through beautiful mathematics, to very down-to-earth, real-world experimental proposals. And this project actually has a little bit of all three built in, so I'll start with the fundamental and end with an experiment. This is upcoming work that should be out very, very soon with my wonderful collaborators. Let me start with some fundamentals that are hopefully not too shocking. So one, information cannot propagate faster than light. And nobody left, so let's try another one. You cannot clone arbitrary quantum information. However, if you look at space-time, and let's say we have some particle, some state that's following a world line, and suppose it has trivial time evolution for now, for simplicity, then this same information has to be replicated all along that world line in some sense. So while we're not cloning on a spatial slice, we are sort of replicating in time in a causal way. And you can ask, well, are there fundamental limitations on this replication beyond, say, these two obvious constraints? And that question was asked and answered by Patrick Hayden and Alex May using the language of causal diamonds. So you're all familiar, this is the intersection of the future and past light cones of two points in space-time. And we can ask, given a collection of such points that define for you a configuration of causal diamonds in spacetime, is it possible to replicate a quantum state or some piece of quantum information in all of those causal diamonds? And this is a, the answer came in the form of a theorem, some necessary and sufficient conditions, that if and only if every pair of diamonds, if there are n diamonds, then every pair means there are n choose two. If they're all causally related, meaning there's a causal curve from one diamond to the other, then you can replicate in whatever in the appropriate sense. And it may not mean that you can always transport the state physically. That's not the case. So there's obviously some freedom here. And let's look at a non-trivial example. And when we do that, keep in mind that since diamonds are defined by two points, if those points are null separated, then these diamonds become line segments. OK, here's a non-trivial example. Let me set it up. Here I have two space one time, and I have three points, three causal diamonds, line segments. And the start points of those diamonds lie on the vertices of an equilateral triangle in the xy plane. The endpoints are on the midpoints of the same triangle, translated up in time so that the diamonds are null. These red curves illustrate that the diamonds are pairwise causally related. And I have some state here. Can this information be replicated in all three of these diamonds? The theorem says that it can, because they're all causally related. So how does this work? And enter quantum information theory. We do this by using quantum error correcting codes. So you can encode this state into a 2-3 secret sharing scheme, which is a quantum error correcting code that has the property that given any two of the three, you can reconstruct the state. But given only one, you can do nothing. You have no information about the state. So there's a null curve from this point to this point. So you can send information from some point in this diamond to another point in this diamond. At least one, yes.
So the black
That's right.
lines are actually
That's right.
diamonds that shrunk down.
Exactly. I need more time, but yeah, there's the diamonds are the black lines, the causal relations are the red lines. Yeah. Exactly. Good. So you use the secret sharing scheme. So if you have access to any two, then you can reconstruct the state. And the way you succeed is to send the state, send one share to each of the three diamonds, so that each diamond has one share of this code. You then transport the shares along those causal curves to their neighboring diamonds. And then what's happened is that each diamond has had access to two of the three shares, so the same information has been replicated in an appropriate sense. And if that was a bit quick, let me go back and do it again and use a different, slightly more operational language, which comes from Adrian Kent, which is summoning. So suppose there's a referee down here holding this state phi, and there are three players. And the referee says, you can have this state unknown to you. You have access to arbitrary quantum resources. What will happen is that at one of these three points, I will tell you that you have to show me this state at one of these three points. So if this were classical data, you could just copy it and broadcast it. Since it's quantum mechanical, they have to be clever. So what they do is they encode it like as so. They each send a share to their three diamonds. And then let's look at diamond one. So player one here has this share. When the other players transport their shares, these shares are going to be sent along to neighboring diamonds. So if the referee happened to tell this player, demonstrate the state for me, then instead of sending her share over to, say, Z0, she would retain her state and just transport it to Z1, collect the share that came from player 2, and reconstruct the state physically holding both of the shares and win the game. And I sort of prefer the slightly more ontological language. Yeah, so player 2 sends a share from here to diamond one. So from diamond two to diamond one. And player one, instead of sending this share, would just have transported it here. I just didn't do the animation. All right. So thank you. So good. So in principle, we could have replicated the state. And so I like to say that it's present sort of as potential, that if somebody demanded that you demonstrate it, that you can. The general scheme, if I give you an arbitrary collection of causal diamonds and the theorem is satisfied, still uses quantum error correcting codes, but they're slightly more complicated. And I don't have time to walk you through the general scheme, but I guess the point of this project is that we discovered a new class of quantum error correcting codes based on some very nice homological ideas. And the nice thing about these codes is that they're based on continuous variables. So I guess you all know that you can perform quantum error correction with qubits, but you can also encode in continuously varying quantities like bosonic modes. You can encode one mode in some large collection and recover against loss of some number of modes. And we did that, and so let me show you an example. Here's another configuration with four diamonds. And the encoding that we use, since these are continuous variables, I've just drawn it as a quantum optics circuit. Quantum optics is a natural avenue. There are other options for experimental realization, but optics is maybe very easy. So the encoding just uses two beam splitters and single mode squeezing. And given this encoding, the players would just hold on to their modes and transport them according to some rule that they can determine ahead of time. And if the referee says, hey, show me the state here and say diamond one, you'll have to take my word for it. That means they lose these three modes, but they can still undo this error, decode, and recover the state using another beam splitter. Similarly, if the referee had said, show me the state in any of these other diamonds, that corresponds to loss of a known subset. These are located errors. And you can reconstruct using some experimentally feasible decoding circuits. And we took some care to make sure that these are experimentally feasible. These are just beam splitters, squeezers, homodyne detection, et cetera.
Bits or whatever can be sent to a specific node, and after the fact that the request is made of which node the information is read out of?
Yeah.
I don't understand that. It seems like even back in your first example, it looked like only one of the three observers could reconstruct.
You can only reconstruct one at a time, of course. So otherwise, you could clone.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought you started out by advertising that you were going to tell us when you can distribute to more than one place.
So you can replicate in the sense of in this abstract sense of having the information as potential or in principle, you could demonstrate the state. So that we say that the state has been replicated if. In principle, in any of the causal diamonds, you could reconstruct the state and verify that you have it. But you can always only do that in, say, one. Or you can reconstruct it in one, and then you could only do it in something that was causally related to those.
Okay.
You can never reproduce the state in two diamonds, because that would be cloning. OK, so yeah, so there's quantum optics. And I guess I can wrap up here. So there's this very nice problem of when and how you can replicate quantum information. And the answer is in the form of necessary and sufficient conditions. Long story short there, you only have to check whether or not you've cloned or signaled. And if those two are not, if you haven't done either of those, then it should be allowed. And we have some class of continuous variable codes that I haven't had a chance to go through based on homology. And a specific example, and I think there's actually, we're in talks with a group in Japan to actually demonstrate this in the laboratory. So I'll end there. Thanks.
All right. We've had a couple of questions. Maybe if there's another last question. Sure.
Say something about the code that you use.
Sure. Yeah. So the general, so maybe I can actually show you a slide. The general, this was part of a long talk. So the general procedure is that you start with some configuration, and you construct a graph of causal relations. So each diamond becomes a vertex, and each edge is these causal relationships. And you assign one mode to each edge. And then from there, what you do is the error model is that you want to be able to reconstruct in any diamond using only shares adjacent to that vertex. And so then it's a graph code that looks like, oh my goodness, hold on. Got Bob Ross and everything. The graph code looks like this. Here it is. Oh my gosh. This was a long talk. Here's one. It's a CSS code. So these are the X-type stabilizers. And then here are the P-type stabilizers. And so that's it. So you work in this sort of symplectic space and makes everything easy.
So you can define this for every graph?
Yeah, as long as the graph, so the structure of the graph is that it has to be complete. That follows from the fact that each and every pair has to be related. And provided that's true and it's an allowed configuration, then you can do this always.
All right, well, I'm going to hit this soon just because before that, I'll invite everyone to go and view the posters downstairs, and I guess the people that made the posters will be available to answer your questions, and we'll thank